going to send you up against the best.
Yes, sir.
You two characters are going to Top Gun.
I feel the need. The need for speed.
5 weeks, you're going to fly against the best fighter pilots in the world.
You guys really are cowboys.
I'm an instructor at this school. I see 20 new hot shots every 8 weeks.
I don't like you because you're unsafe.
That's right.
I am dangerous.
Figured it out yet?
What's that?
Who's the best pilot?
No, I think I can figure that one out on my own.
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie, call sign The Goblin.
I'm Francesco, call sign Italy Man.
We're bad at coming up with call signs. This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve to have a badly lit sex scene with Kelly McGillis.
Fireman. Fireman was right there.
Oh, you should have picked Fireman.
Iceman and Fireman. God.
Oh, I see what you're doing. Joining us today is a returning champion of the podcast, Will Paxton. How are you, Will?
Not too bad. I can't think of a great call sign, but so I'll go as Goose 2 Electric Boogaloo.
What's your drag name?
Pax of Fags. Mother of the House of Fags.
Okay, so you could have gone with that.
I'm going to go, yeah, Pax. Just Pax. Or...
So today we are talking about the 1986 Tony Scott movie Top Gun. And I, for one, am very excited.
I can tell. So excited.
I am.
Yeah.
Are you guys excited?
I'm excited for the episode.
I love seeing you both. Top Gun is a film.
Do you not like Top Gun?
I didn't like Top Gun. No.
We're going to get into it.
Well, yes, we are. We are going to get into it. I'm very excited to talk about it.
All right. So just a little synopsis on Top Gun. For Lieutenant Pete Maverick Mitchell and his friend and co-pilot, Nick Goose Bradshaw, being accepted into an elite training school for fighter pilots is a dream come true, but a tragedy as well as personal demons will threaten Pete's dreams of becoming an ace pilot. Does it?
They do.
I also don't think he's an ace pilot.
He's the best of the best.
No, he's not.
He's the second best.
He's the second best of the second best.
Yeah, he is the second best of the second best because he's not as good as Cougar and he's not as good as Iceman.
No, both times he is second to someone else. And I think his arc in the film, and we're going to get into this, is him accepting, I don't need to be the best. I just need to be really good. I need to be the best me I can be.
But he's dangerous.
No, he's not.
He lives life on the edge.
No, he doesn't.
He's got a need.
He just says that to like get
speed.
He says that to get at Iceman. He's not actually that if you listen to like the way his voice changes, he's so like projecting, he's not actually that dangerous.
But see, he does all those dangerous maneuvers.
He goes upside down. I've been upside down.
Not on a jet?
No, but I've done it.
Well done. I want to know the context now. When did you last go upside down, Charlie?
I don't want to talk about it. But yeah, so Will, you didn't like this film.
I'll tell you what I did like. I liked that it has very sort of GoldenEye aesthetics and like music.
Do you mean GoldenEye the film or GoldenEye the video game?
Both. I mean the large dongs, the dong dong, like all that
the
kind of stuff.
The large what?
The large dongs. And I guess, well, you know, those type, different type of large dongs. Maybe gongs is the right word. Gongs. The large gongs. And like this very sort of electronic 80s, 90s. I love that. I was immediately excited when I saw it. And then the film started properly. And then I just found it a sort of big bro wank fest that I didn't fully love. But I understand the themings of it. I was talking to someone about it and he said it's in that time it's very open and like quite, what's the word, less bro-y than bro films have been up to that point.
Yeah, it's not a Stallone or a Seagal or a Schwarzenegger, and we'll get Schwarzenegger later. But
yes.
It's like, it might be a good time to make a point I was planning to make later, but it comes at such a strange time for blockbusters.
Mm.
Because the modes you have are sort of the, you know, early baby boomers like Spielberg and George Lucas and, you know, the Indiana Jones and the Star Wars, which are kind of riffing on either international films or old stories. Or you have films like Back to the Future, E.T., The Goonies, which are kind of focused on younger characters. This, I think, is the biggest 80s movie to have at its core a new movie star.
Mm.
And a young movie star. He's 24 when he makes this movie.
I did not know that. That's wow.
But that's why I think...
Is this his vehicle, so to speak?
He was already, like, going up, but I think this launches him into movie stardom.
Right, okay.
And also the way that he takes such ownership of this film. Like, he is giving script notes. He is giving basically mandates to what pictures of him can and can't be used in publicity. He didn't want to, like, have his shirt off in all the posters. He is very forthright about what he wants this film to be, and it absolutely pays off in the career that he has following this. And it is such a movie star performance, I think. I think it's a very good acting performance as well, but that's sort of overshadowed by how charismatic he is throughout the whole film.
Yeah, he does remind me throughout the film, like, of the energy of him jumping on Oprah's couch is the energy that I see in this film from Tom Cruise.
See, I disagree. I think the energy of him jumping on Oprah's couch is only in the bits where he's like to Iceman, oh, I'm dangerous, you should be scared of me. Which, to me, is fake. Like, that's not fake in the movie sense. It's Maverick being fake to look big in front of Iceman, and I think maybe part of it is that the fake Maverick or the fake Tom Cruise becomes Tom Cruise.
Ooh, I like that. That's interesting.
I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts about this film. What do you think, Francesco?
Well, in regards to it being a weird blockbuster and a Broadway movie, I find it interesting how basically the vast majority of this film is a romance melodrama. The fighting jet scenes are by far the most boring, and most of the emotional stakes are around the love story, which is shot like a TV melodrama, and it's so sappy and saccharine, and like, no wonder why this movie is so gay. It's not just the shirtless volleyball scene. It's a very, very gay film. And I don't know, they didn't intend for it to be, which makes it even gayer, I think.
Well, the love story bit that you're talking about, the reason why it feels so stylized is because it's mostly reshoots.
Okay.
They added a lot of the romance stuff because
it was too gay.
Not quite that, but it's the fact that in test screenings, people were just like, Tom Cruise is really hot in this film. We need to give him even more reason for young women to go and see this film.
But that's why I think even the romance stuff is, in a way, gay, because it's a female gaze. It's not male gazey towards the lead actress. It's the two of them sitting on the porch, just lounging, and it's like doom, and it's so mundane, and it's so like sweet and saccharine. I don't believe those were aimed at the boy audience. Those scenes.
It's like the film is like a magazine cover of like Playgirl or something.
I mean, like, there's no nudity. The sex is very, like I said, stylized.
Stylized, yeah.
And partly because it was reshoots, and Kelly McGillis had brown hair.
Oh.
Which is why in a lot of those scenes she's wearing a hat.
Oh, right.
So because she looks completely different, because they're going back to it. But I think that really helps it not be, you know, not exploitative is the wrong word, but overly trashy in the romance sense. I think there's some, like, trashy stuff. It's kind of a sports movie. It's kind of a high school movie.
I think that actually it wasn't that trashy in the romance. I was very impressed with how...
I don't mean trashy in a derogatory way.
No. I mean that... I suppose I do in that sense. But I like how it takes its time to really develop the romance in this film. I'm complimenting it. Maybe I do like it after all this time.
I think Kelly McGillis is really good in the film.
Kelly McGillis is really good. My favourite character in the film is Goose's wife.
Meg Ryan.
That's Meg Ryan!
Yes! Pre-When Harry Met Sally, Meg Ryan. She is so good in this film.
Oh, with the most 80s of 80s hair in the world. The amount of frizz on that hair is fantastic.
Okay, her and Anthony Edwards have so much chemistry.
So much chemistry.
Like, I believe that those two... Actually, I don't believe that those two have only one kid.
Yeah!
That is how much chemistry they have.
I get that. It's really lovely. I think that just the way that she acts and the way that she's got so much joy, and then later on where there's so much pathos for her as well in that scene.
A character that on paper would only exist to motivate Maverick is given so much life by that performance.
Yes, exactly.
And I genuinely can't imagine anyone else. I was so gutted she isn't in the sequel.
Is she not?
No.
What a
you've not seen, neither of you have seen the sequel?
No, not yet.
I think the sequel's really good. But I also think the flight scenes in this are... I really like them.
I'm just not interested in anything related to the flight school plot.
See, I don't love the flying scenes at the beginning and at the end when they're against kind of the Russians.
Well, yeah.
Well, they're Russians because they've got black visors and they've got black gloves. Like, it's so obvious when it's like Russians in movies.
There's a red star on their helmet as well.
But it's also, less the Russians and more the communists. Mm.
But they never go into who they're fighting because they say it's peacetime.
Well, it's a Cold War film, so the enemy's just everything and everywhere. But I think fundamentally, like, I mean, I understand the criticism of, like, we don't know who they're fighting, it's just this faceless anime. This is not a war movie. As you said, it's a high school movie, it's a sports movie. Most of the flying is them doing, it's training.
I was shocked how much of, I was expecting this to be a vehicle of Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer together. When I watched the film, Iceman's not in it. At really that much at all.
He's a fair bit, but I get what you're saying.
He's not, in terms of being a foil, he's not the person. He's you're right. He's just right, and so there's not much sort of argument or stuff like that. He's always just in the corner, being like, "Well, that was a bit dangerous, wasn't it, Maverick?" But like that's kind of like his role throughout the film, and actually that does give a bit of pathos when the last line is like, "You can be my wingman at any time." Those are the two moments of the film that I loved are everything around Goose's death and everything around, and then the end is the end bit of that last wingman scene and the celebrations. I'm excited. It reminds me of New Hope in lots of ways.
I see it.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like the everyone's going out, everyone's cheering, everyone's like giving each other kisses and all that kind of stuff.
But the fact that Maverick's objective for most of the film is to get the Top Gun prize.
Mm.
And then once Goose dies, he doesn't even want that. That could like floor a film, but the film becomes so much about him coming to terms with himself and the stuff that he's trying to live up to, because his father... All right, is his father a war criminal? Because the implication is that he was in Cambodia or something where pilots from the US Navy shouldn't have been.
I suppose. It was such a quick bit of backstory that I was like, hang on, wait, what was the exact... What's he do? I don't know. Okay, I feel like more things should have hinged on this. But yeah, it was more... Again, it was that thing of... I think that... And one of my key issues with the film is that Maverick gets every chance in the book. And I think there is a... And we come back later, I feel like, on the representations of the military in different films that we're watching today. And there is a certain sense of classism to this thing of, like, these people can do whatever they want at whatever stakes.
Well, that's... I'm really looking forward to comparing it to my pick.
Mm.
Because I think we'll talk a lot more about... Like, these are all... These guys could have all gone to college.
Yes, exactly.
Like, these are the elite of the Navy.
And also gives them the power to do... Like, it feels like they've got a lot less responsibility with their stuff. Like, everything's very... all of their lifestyle is not portrayed as, like, hard militaristic. They're just in lectures, and then they're going to bars. And
there's no drill training.
There's no drill training.
Which there is in the sequel.
Oh, is there?
Well, not quite drill training, but, like... There are penalties if you screw up and you have to do a bunch of press-ups.
Is it topless with oil on it, by any chance?
Yes.
Because that's the genre of film we're talking about. We're talking about Top Gun. There must be oil.
It is a very oily film.
So, Rick Rossovich as Slider. I mean, that he in this film is just basically a vehicle, again, like that Playgirl sensibility, of just, like, showing up in scenes topless with oil on him, doing a pose, and then, like, that whole...
But I think he's the only one whose main function is to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just to quickly shout out, as we've said, Val Kilmer, I think, is really good in this film.
Yeah, well, there's a scene where, like, the first, like, scene where they're in a locker room where, like, Maverick and Iceman, like doing their first bit of, like, playthings. And they're basically just, like, salivating each other. So much lip action, like, not actually... It's just, like, Maverick bites his lip, and then Iceman bites his lip, and they sort of, like, ha-ha. Like, it's all very, very, very exciting.
Unsurprisingly, my favourite character in this film is Viper.
Yes.
Played by the legendary Tom Skerritt.
He is fab, and he's got one of those fantastic moustaches, which means that you know he's in charge in a military place.
But he never raises his voice.
He never raises his voice, exactly.
He is a calm, reasonable authority figure who can fly the fuck out of a plane.
Mm.
And we want to quickly jump now to a message from friend of the show and future guest, Will Smith, who is our chief Skerritt correspondent.
The Will Smith.
The first Will Smith.
The first, yeah. Will Smith.
Our friend Will Smith from the University of Birmingham, not the actor Will Smith who slapped Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Hello to the listener of Because You've Watched on this episode of Top Gun. My name is Will, and I have a theory that I'd like to share with you that I call damp versus dry, and it's about Top Gun and the character Viper, played by Tom Skerritt. So, Top Gun's emotional journey could be described as a movement from fear to control, from instability to stability. This is visually represented at every turn by images of moisture, wetness, dampness, gallons of sweat, buckets of tears, the ocean battlegrounds, numerous post-shower scenes, and the moistest volleyball game ever played in which Tom Cruise wears jeans, which I think is a psychotic move, which is frankly very telling about his character. So, what is there to ground Maverick, this jeans-wearing maniac, the dampest of every character in Top Gun? Who but Viper, played by Tom Skerritt? So, in a sea of sweaty young airmen and rampant hormones, Skerritt's Viper stands apart with his Lego Man haircut and stoic brush of a moustache. Let's focus on the most pivotal moment of the film, in my opinion, Goose's death, which involves an ocean rescue, let's not forget. Maverick, after this, is naturally a mess of sweat and tears, staring in the mirror post-shower. Who comes to check on him? Who but the dry, dry, man-in-charge Viper? A few scenes later, when Maverick's all but quit, who gives sage advice through the medium of a mythic, respectfully told backstory? Viper. He even wears a Top Gun hat just to reassure us that he is the best of them all, the guy, the man, and also to remind us of the title of the movie in case we've forgotten. Now, Viper is the driest character in Top Gun, the only person who can balance out the damp. This film is rife with sweat and hormones, the open ocean, booze, blood, other implied bodily fluids, but Viper is the one who stops that flood. He is a dusty old rock, emotionally stable and brimming with dry, empathetic reason. In summary, Viper rules, Skerritt rules, and I would give Top Gun probably 5 out of 10.
So, no, just Will Smith and I just have a running joke that every time Tom Skerritt is in a movie, it just makes the movie at least like 10% better.
It's a great Skerritt.
This is a great Skerritt.
This is a great Skerritt.
This is some great Skerritt.
Other notes that I have from this film, just sort of loose notes, and then I can sort of get back to more some theme stuff. Tom Cruise is a terrible kisser. There is a moment where he kisses Kelly, and he's
a lot of tongue.
Lot of tongue there, and I was not very impressed with any of that. There's lots of like, you were larger than life, now look at you. There's lots of like quotable lines that are sort of
your mouse writing checks that your body can't cash.
Exactly. And I wonder, chicken and egg thing, like, are these things that have just been in the consciousness for years, or are these like Top Gun quotes that I have never known before but actually are Top Gun quotes?
Probably a bit of both.
Popularized by Top Gun.
Yeah, I mean, the Need for Speed thing, that turns up in Captain Marvel.
Oh yes, it does.
There's a whole video game series named after it.
You know, I like this film a lot. I think it's a very cute film. I think not all of it is perfect.
It's a silly film.
It's so silly.
Yeah.
The thing I did want to mention, I mean, Francesco alluded to it, and a lot of people have sort of reinterpreted it, partly because of a Quentin Tarantino theory that it's about a man coming to terms with his homosexuality. That's what Top Gun's about, and that's why it's so good. I'm not saying that that's the case, but I did wonder, Will, did you have an explicitly queer reading of it when watching it?
It's interesting because I've heard a lot about that reading of this film, and I was excited to see it and look at it through that gaze. And then the more and more I was watching it, the more and more I was like, I'm getting more of a camp aesthetic vibe with it. I'm getting more sort of like a film that is about male intimacy. And I think we talked about this in the last podcast.
We
about
did.
Male intimacy and homosexuality and themes of queerness getting sometimes conflated, and sometimes they are. You can have one or the other. In this film, I think it's more about a male intimacy than it is about specific queer yearning or romance or someone trying to come out and stuff like that. I see Maverick more as someone who plays on his feminine sides to become more masculine.
I completely agree with you. I think that films that do normalize heterosexual or at least non-sexual male intimacy are really positive.
Yes.
And you don't see it a lot of the time. I mean, part of this is just the internet being what it is and people having fun, and that's absolutely fine. But when two men are close on screen, there is a section of the internet which quite adorably wants them to be in love.
Yes. The shippers come out and ship them.
Which I love.
Mm-hmm.
For the record, I think that's a lot of fun. But I do think that a film like this normalizing male intimacy, male platonic love, and male grief is really powerful without that. And the ability to also manage healthy relationships with women while having these close relationships with your male friends.
Yeah, look, paradoxically, wanting these characters to be gay plays into the idea that men can't be intimate unless they're gay.
Yeah.
Which is quite harmful.
But having said that,
It's still fun.
It's of course it yeah. is. Yeah. So I'm not. If someone has an explicitly queer reading of this film, and also queer doesn't necessarily mean gay. It just means playing with themes of gender and sexuality. Yeah. But I don't know why I looked at Will when I said that. He knows that.
Thank you.
Thank you for explaining queerness. But I'm not saying that that people's reading of that wouldn't be legitimate. But I agree with Will that it's not. It's not the forefront for me, at least.
Yeah. And I think that when this argument from Tarantino is made is in the 90s, and I think in the 90s. Like there is a bit more understanding of what specifically a gay male person is, but also still all of the trappings and traumas of like male intimacy can equal gay stuff. So I think Tarantino's theory, and I know that it was written for a sort of scene in a film and now it's been expounded on in his real life, I think that just goes into Quentin Tarantino's stuff about male intimacy.
I think insofar as Maverick himself is concerned, this is a straight film, but a lot of the film seems, as I said earlier, to be made for a queer audience or for a diverse audience. This is not a boys' film for boys. Mm. There's a lot of it that tries to pander to different demographics. That's why it invites such a reading.
It is really interesting that queer audiences turn out really loyally for everything other than explicitly queer films. Like, they've turned up for Megan, but not Bros.
Yeah, and I think that there is something so... Like, I think the gayest thing about this film is Meg Ryan. And I think that says all in a nutshell. Like, for some reason, I'm like more like, I don't know if I want to see the gay male intimacy. But unless it's really, really well done and speaks to my experience, I don't want to sort of get the crumbs. But I'll see Meg Ryan camping it up for sure with a frizzy blonde wig.
Although Kelly McGillis is sort of... Her outfits in this are very... It's, you know, what you've referred to as high camp.
It is high camp. And when she puts the hat on, especially. And now that I know there's a brown wig underneath there, the campness just increases.
I love that you call all women's hair wigs, even when it's just her hair.
That's no, it's
done.
A wig. It's a wig.
It's not a wig, it's her hair.
It's a wig.
But like when she turns up to training, she's wearing like those stockings.
It's a full wig. It includes the stockings.
It's part of the wig.
It's attached. It's all
attached.
That's
not even when she would be wearing the wig.
You put the wig on and then you put it like a bodysuit underneath.
Oh, God. Ah, she's so hot in this movie.
Okay, so any last thoughts?
Yes. I have one more and then we really need to move on. The bar scene.
Yes.
I was thinking this and I wanted to ask Will this especially because you've known me a very long time. Mm-hmm. Going up to a girl at a bar and badly singing a really old song... to her. Is that something I would do?
It is something you would do. I think what makes it probably more charming if you would do that is that I don't think you'd have the companion who's like wingmanning you into it, who starts the song off, or like, excuse me, miss, etc. And then that thing happens. That makes everything more cringy. You would just go up to the woman and just start singing, which is simultaneously...
No, I think I would only do it if I was with you or someone. But getting everyone to join in would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, oh, that's true. The My whole favorite. Bar joined in.
I My think favorite. That's what makes it creepy for me.
Yeah, I know.
It puts her on the spot so much.
It was when
she's
she said
so
yes.
uncomfortable. Yeah. She plays it so well. My favorite bit is when they start talking and this random guy just picks up the mic and keeps singing.
I never noticed
Everyone
that.
Is having a great time. It's the black pilot who starts on the second verse when Maverick's already done with it.
Oh, that's fab. And he's like, use that trick, someone else.
I will say following her into the toilet is bad.
Oh, yeah, that's... yeah.
That's a weird thing he does.
My notes go in all capitals at that point. I'm like, what are you doing?
There's a line that Meg Ryan has to Kelly McGillis, and she says, oh, hearts are breaking all over the world tonight because Maverick's off the market. But I think that he is his least attractive as a person, not just as a romantic prospect, when he's trying to be this hyper-masculine ideal of a pilot.
Mm.
But when he's just being real and being really passionate about... He's just a plane nerd. Mm. He's a nerd for planes. And people seem to find that adorable about him.
Yeah. And I think when he becomes Mitchell and not Maverick, I think Maverick is like Maverick's like the bad side.
Yeah.
When he's just himself, it's actually what should be... Yeah.
And that's why I think Viper's such a good character, because he just says it how it is and doesn't put on a show for anyone.
Mm.
He's like, no, I just think this and I'm just explaining this to you. And he calls shit out. Viper's the best, and I think without Viper, Maverick can't develop into the person he is at the end of the film.
That's a lovely note to leave it on.
All right, let's talk availability. You can stream this on Sky and Now Cinema, and you can rent and buy it on YouTube, Microsoft, Chili, Google Play, Amazon, Rakuten TV, Apple TV, and the Sky Store. All right, let's move on to our next film. Shall we play the trailer?
The trailer.
Position! En avant! En haut! En bas! En haut! Milieu! En haut! Milieu! En haut! En bas! En haut! En bas! En haut! Milieu! En haut! Milieu! En bas! Milieu! En bas! Milieu! En bas! En haut!
Beau Travail, a 1999 film directed by Claire Denis. Foreign Legion officer Galoup recalls his once glorious life leading troops in the Gulf of Djibouti. His existence there was happy, strict, and regimented. But the arrival of a promising young recruit, Santan, plants the seeds of jealousy in Galoup's mind. Now, this, it's a very famous film. It just had its debut in the top 10 of all time Sight and Sound list of 2022. The reason why I chose it for this episode, first of all, its portrayal of the military through mindless routine training exercises, most of which have this gaze towards naked male bodies posing. And secondly, the fact that, as a bit of historical context for this before we open the discussion, the Foreign Legion was a regiment of the French military that included soldiers from 27 different countries that weren't just from France, and they were usually sent abroad to help France in its colonialist efforts. They were sent to Algeria, they were sent to, you know, everywhere basically that France colonized or tried to conquer. But this is a time that is post-decolonization, so these Foreign Legion troops in Djibouti are basically lingering in a country that they no longer have control over. They got no one to fight. And we were talking about the enemy in Top Gun being anonymous. Here, there is literally no enemy. They're doing this training. So there's this scene early on that is literally them doing an incursion into an abandoned building, pointing their guns at nobody. And it's almost about this like pointlessness and fruitlessness of their military exercises, which I think echoes with a lot of Top Gun, quite a lot. But let's open the discussion now. What do you guys think?
I really liked it. I was aware of this film for a long time before I saw it. I knew that this was a very highly regarded film, and I went in with that mindset, and maybe that doesn't help your viewing of the film. But having said that, I really like this film. I really want to rewatch it as well. There's just, because it's not a particularly plotty film, especially in the first half, it feels like a vibe movie. It reminded me of another film that you've chosen on this podcast, Western.
Oh, 100%.
But it also reminded me a lot of Shakespeare's Othello, because so much of that is about this garrison of soldiers just stuck in a place with no one to fight and nothing really to do other than just get pissy at each other.
Oh yeah, that's what this film is.
And it feels really, realist is kind of the wrong word, but it is very humanist. And that you are just watching these people sort of go about their lives, but that doesn't stop there being this feeling of tension bubbling up.
Well, the soundtrack helps a lot with that.
The soundtrack is, I mean, it's mostly Benjamin Britten compositions, so it's not new for the film. And Benjamin Britten is, you know, wonderful composer from, you know, the early 20th century, but it does so much work in a way that I think Moffy does as well, which we'll get to, because that's also got a very powerful score. It was just very interesting. Will, what did you think?
I think that there's a lot of nuance with the, because you just get to see people play out their lives, you get to learn a lot about their characters through the way they do their routine. And there's no like big speeches or big monologues where they reveal their intentions, they reveal their plots, they reveal what they need to do. And it makes me feel more attached and then detached and then slightly disgusted at people like Gallup, for example. By the end of the film, I really had a deep distaste of what he was doing, and it was harder because I understood how that was created, in the same way that I feel disgust at what Othello's actions in Shakespeare does, but I'm still following Othello and rooting for Othello in the first of three sort of acts of that play.
But this isn't an Othello podcast.
No, it's not an Othello podcast, but lovely reference, Charlie. But I thought that Gallup is one of potentially one of the most glum people in film ever, I think.
Very possibly.
He may be the glummest. And glum is the word. I've never seen a man who's more glum, but I get
it. I would say he's down in the dumps.
He is down in the dumps.
In those dumps.
Yeah. And it made me think about the aestheticism of sort of the male body with also, like, there's a sense of shame and stuff like that that I can really read a lot of queer themes into this movie because of the idea of shame, jealousy, guilt, the appreciation and denigration of the male body. But without it being a necessary queer story, or it's got queer themes that are not necessarily about queer relationships, but queerness in terms of the internal struggles.
My reading of Galou and Forestier, I think, impacted the rest of it, because the way I sort of saw it was these are two veterans of the Gulf War. And they have seen combat, whereas the recruits that are all significantly younger than them have only really known peace in their adult lives. So there's this sense of, you have Forestier, who just loves his men, and they love him, and he's sort of this benevolent father figure, whereas Galou wants to maintain the discipline and intensity that he has known as a man of the military. They are both, you know, career soldiers, but one of whom has projected his life onto the military, whereas Galou has internalized the military into his life.
Yeah, well, thinking of this as a queer film, Galou reminds me a lot of Benedict Cumberbatch in Power of the Dog as a character.
There is a queer reading, but there's also a paternal reading.
That's the thing. You don't know whether Galou's hatred and just animosity towards Saint-Anne is motivated by some repressed sexual feelings or just jealousy of the fact that Saint-Anne seems to be beloved by all of his comrades.
Really, and his mentor.
And by his mentor, yeah, and Galou clearly isn't. And, you know, Will, you mentioned earlier how we don't really get into... It's not a very talky film, so we don't really hear much of what the characters think. But the big exception to that is Galou himself, as he narrates the film through this diary that he writes, you know, chronologically at the end of the film, and he's telling the story in flashback, and we know that he's being dishonorably discharged and sent back to France. And the way that he writes is very poetic, it's very literary, it's very evocative. This almost feels like a literary adaptation at points because of the way that he describes many things, but also the way that we don't get to see or hear many dialogues, we get to hear him describe what was said in voiceover.
But what I found so powerful about that, and yeah, you're right, this isn't a quote-unquote silent film. There is a fair amount of speech in it, but there is very little dialogue, and for me that really drove home just how isolated Galou is. Because in an environment that is so intense and so intimate, like we see in Top Gun, like we see in Moffy, that you have these groups of men who are packed in very tight and are seeing each other every day and working and training with each other every day, there would be more speech than this. There would be more conversation. But no one is talking to our viewpoint character.
Yeah.
And I think that that choice is so rooted in how, A, people see Galou, but also how he interprets people interacting with him.
And you learn so much about his character just by looking at the way that he treats his men under his command. One of my favourite bits of sort of character building this film does is this. It's quite near the beginning of the film, where he's making them do press-ups, and then he gets down and does the press-ups with them and starts adding a jump press-up into it that none of the rest of them are doing. But he's kind of in that moment, he showcases, like, I am equally as fit as all of you. When he does the running exercise, he's at the front of the pack, but also he is a part as well as that. So he's got to keep, as a character, has to be on top of this. He has to be the most ultimate person in the military in a situation where he's kind of doing nothing.
And that's why I think they hired Denis Lavant to play him, because Denis Lavant was a professional gymnast. He was actually doing all of those stunts himself.
Denis Lavant just has one of the all-time great faces in cinema. But to your point that he gets involved and does everything himself, it is such a trope in military movies that, you know, the benevolent officer who wouldn't ask you to do anything they wouldn't be willing to do themselves. And he, on paper, does that, but it doesn't seem to endear him at all. He just is, at least in our perception, and from his perspective, such an unlikable figure that even the fact that his harshness is meted out to himself, it doesn't seem to do any good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the tragedy, is that he can't really make any friends.
Yeah. And the biggest relationship I think he has in his life is smoking. Like, it's one of those things where, like, you can see how much care and, like, how much he puts into, like, rolling the cigarettes. And it's always like, if he gets annoyed, etc., the first thing he reaches to is a cigarette.
But yeah, so much of Garou's character is meticulousness. The way that he folds laundry, you know, the way that he makes his bed in a later scene, and also the way that he teaches that same meticulousness to his recruits as they are, you know, ironing clothes and stuff like that.
Francesco is doing great hand movements to show ironing clothes.
Yeah. No, exactly. Very active ironing. I want to see how you iron now.
It's great for an audio medium.
But yeah, no, last point I wanted to make, or last question I wanted to ask, was addressing the role of the Djibouti locals in the film, because I think so much of the more documentary tendencies of the film come from there. Well, the scene I alluded to earlier of them doing that training in the abandoned building ends with an elongated shot of a bunch of locals just looking at them and laughing. There's also so many scenes in the club, which seems to be an echoing theme throughout all three of our military movies today, that they also show how these military men go out in the club, go flirting with girls. But here, the focus seems to be on the local women dancing and almost looking straight at the camera at times. There's one particular shot of Galou's local girlfriend, like, staring straight into the camera. And I don't know, like, the presence of the Djibouti locals in this film, they speak even less than the French characters. They're functionally voiceless. But they have such a penetrative gaze, and we're seeing so much of this from their perspective, that they're a presence that can't be ignored, and they shouldn't be ignored, obviously. I was just wondering what you thought of all of that.
I always think about it. There's a Black Mirror episode called White Bear, and there are spectators in that are sort of viewing what is going on as the audience, so to speak. I kind of view the people of Djibouti in that same respect, is they're kind of like watching on as these people who have sort of colonized their country, and that they've got no need in colonization to be there, watching them doing nothing.
Yeah, I mean, the vibe is very much, at least from the point of view of the Djibouti people, and not, obviously we don't see a lot from their perspective, but we see a lot of how Galou sees them looking at him and the French Foreign Legion. It's almost like they're looking at tourists.
Mm.
If you compare it to scenes in other military movies where a veteran or someone on duty goes into a bar in uniform, people are kind of impressed, but they seem more bemused than anything else here. It's almost like, didn't you just leave?
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and I think that it is such a deliberate choice by Denis to have those perspectives of native people in Djibouti, but particularly of women, just interacting with, on a limited basis, this hyper-masculine, hyper-European, even though it consists of members from all over the world, with this sort of confusion. Because I could see, even with you, it's hard to explain why the French Foreign Legion exists.
Yeah.
And what it does.
Yeah, and it's almost like we as the audience are going through the same experience. We're watching these humdrum exercises. After an hour, we're probably starting to wonder, okay, what are they doing? What are they training for? Why are they there?
Mm.
I still feel like the exercises are hypnotic, just watching them train.
There's something like Tai Chi-ish about training.
Yes, there is. I was going to say there's a yoga aspect of it.
It's very zen.
It's very, very zen. But also, in terms of ramping up the tension, some of the scenes where they're doing the sort of Tai Chi exercises, at one point they do a drag queen dip, which I particularly love. when they're doing all these exercises...
By the way, all the exercises were real. They consulted actually for a Foreign Legion.
One of the cast members had been in the Foreign Legion.
Wow.
So he just led them in doing what he'd done.
So they actually did the drag queen drop in the Foreign Legion.
That is fantastic. Again, the sort of... And we'll come up with this later.
Will is now pro-colonialism.
No. It's just fascinating to see how all stuff that is kind of the routine of being hyper-masculine is inherently camp and ridiculous.
But sorry, you were making a point,
like,
here.
Yes, so I think a lot of those scenes had the big moments of Benjamin Britten score in it, and so it's those sort of like routine hypnotic stuff in terms of what you're talking about, being some hypnotic for the audience. The music really amps up the tension in that sort of hypnotic bit as well.
But there's often no music during the training scene, so at least the ones I remember, it's all diegetic sounds of like skin against skin, of them like dragging their feet on the ground, that really heightens their bodily presence in the moment.
Mm.
But then when the music is added on top of those, is when we're seeing them more from Galoo's perspective, as he's getting more and more frustrated and angrier, and something is building up inside him. So it's a nice contrast of both.
And I always think that those scenes are the moments where they're doing the yoga and Tai Chi stuff. When it's the calmest, Galoo is the most frantic, and yes, that's the music choices make that.
100%. But yeah, last point, this film has the best credit scene of all time.
I don't want to spoil, but it is so good. If you don't watch the film and you don't think you'll ever watch the film, I'm sure there are plenty of people putting the final bit of this film on YouTube.
And if you're watching that without context and it doesn't make any sense, don't worry. It's, you know, watch the film and you'll understand a bit more about it, maybe.
It's so amazing, yeah. And I actually really want to see versions of it which are put to different music.
I will be signing off every WhatsApp message with a GIF of that from now on.
Anyway, shall we talk availability?
Yes, this film is available to stream on BFI Player. It's also on the Criterion channel if you're in the US and you have that. And I'm sure there are plenty of DVD and Blu-ray versions that you can order. I predict this will become more available on VOD in the next year or so, just because more people are talking about it following the Sight and Sound poll.
Ah, we can only hope.
Yeah, I mean, Claire Denis is still around.
She's still making movies.
Push Claire. Push her. I don't know where to. Let's move on to our next pick, which is my film. Let's play the trailer.
Would you like a drink, Renick?
No, I'm fine, thanks.
Are you sure? You know where we're going?
Vergeet van alles wat jy dink jy weet. Jy is nie meer iemand nie. Julle is rowe.
Sewe.
En is ons werk.
Acht.
Julle rowe mans te probeer maak.
Nege.
Sugar man. Met a false friend. On a lonely, dusty road.
Sugar Man.
Moffy is a 2019 film directed by Oliver Hermanus. Moffy follows the story of Nicholas Vanderswet. From a very young age, he realizes he is different. Try as he may, he cannot live up to the macho image expected of him by his family, by his heritage. Set during the South African border war against communism, this is a long overdue story about the emotional and physical suffering endured by countless young men. So, just a bit of context. I was aware of this film for a few years now. I became aware of it because it was nominated for a BAFTA. I'm just trying to remember which BAFTA it was. And I was like, and I looked into it, but I never got around to watching it. And I thought, this actually looks really, really interesting. So it was nominated for Outstanding Debut by a British Writer, Director, or Producer. And yeah, it was produced by Jack Sidey and written by Jack Sidey, who is British and his first film. It's not Oliver Hermanus' first film, but it looked really interesting. And then when we were doing Top Gun, I thought of it, looked into it, and thought, you know, this looked perfect. I did think, just from what I'd seen, that it was more specifically about the queer experience in the military of apartheid South Africa. Having seen it, I think it's a better pick for a Top Gun episode than I originally thought when I picked it.
There's a shirtless volleyball scene.
Yes, which wasn't a deliberate homage to Top Gun, but when it was screened, everyone thought it was a reference to Top Gun.
I just find it funny that you didn't know that was there when you picked the film. The crucial difference between the volleyball scene in Moffy and the volleyball scene in Top Gun is that I think both of them are kind of used as almost like playful breaks right before a pivotal plot scene, if you will. Like, you know, a long scene where nothing plotty really happens. But whereas in Top Gun, the end of the scene is a slow transition into do-do-do-do-tune, which starts playing as the guys are still hugging each other.
The song's called Take My Breath Away.
That's called do-do-do-do-do.
Oh, you're right.
Which starts playing as the guys are still hugging each other. The ending of the volleyball scene in Moffy is absolutely traumatic in circumstances that I won't spoil, so it's an interesting contrast.
But the fact that it is going so much more into the limitations of the hypermasculine rather than the possibilities of the hypermasculine, and, you know, the abuse that goes on in military settings to this day, and we don't need to get into that too much because this is specifically about a period and a place that is different to Top Gun, but it sort of takes the tropes that you could argue were sort of made very popular by films like Full Metal Jacket, of the sort of very intense, very harsh and quite funny drill sergeant bullying recruits, and, you know, really shows the toll of that in a very realist way. And I think there, the negatives of that are definitely shown in Full Metal Jacket, but it is very heightened.
See, whereas I think in Full Metal Jacket, there is a space for the sergeant to be funny. I didn't find anything about the sergeant in this film funny at all. No. He was terrifying. But yeah, we should probably preface that, yeah, this is a very difficult film to watch. And whereas Top Gun maybe focuses on the more positive, celebratory, glorifying aspects of the military, and Ultra Vile focuses more on the humdrum day-to-day, this film certainly amplifies and heightens the more abusive, negative, like just outright horrifying aspects of
even
that
before they actually join the war.
Yeah.
And I think that it's also, like we talked about in Top Gun, the sort of the class aspects of it. In this film, it's a very different point of view you're given. You're given the point of view of a 16-year-old that joining the military for training right at the bottom, as opposed to like the high-flying, what's the word? Shots.
Anyway, hot shots.
As opposed to the high-flying hot shots that are in Top Gun.
Although, you're not referencing the film Hot Shots starring Charlie Sheen.
No, I would not. No.
But it is interesting that even though class is such a part of this film, that Nicholas and Michael, who are two of the main characters, and Stassen, they do seem to be more middle class. I think Nicholas is technically Afrikaan, but he mostly speaks English.
Well, he has an Afrikaan surname, but his family is mostly British, I think.
Or at least have been upwardly mobile, so they mostly speak English.
Yeah, well, his mum has a British accent, I remember. And the
South African accent.
Yeah.
She is South African.
Yeah, but I do remember the other recruits make fun of him for being English, in inverted commas.
Yeah, I think I related with Nicholas a lot. I related with both Nicholas and Sax a lot, which it's interesting because Nicholas is like, similar to this sort of audience idea, so many of Nicholas's scenes, he's kind of viewing what's going on. He's not an active part of what's happening. He's sort of having lots of things that's going around him. And you see the toll that takes on his own mental health throughout the film. And I can kind of relate to that in terms of sort of a queer lens of a sort of a queer viewing thing of like seeing what's going on around you and trying to assimilate and trying to work things out, like giving the porn mag over and then taking back the photo of his dad and all that kind of stuff. Like there's an acclimation that you can see is having a deep impact on him, but it also is really interesting to see the visual cues. And I think that one of the main scenes I saw that is the comparison between this volleyball scene and then the Top Gun's volleyball scene, is that Tom Cruise in the volleyball scene as your main protagonist, he's in the action, he's doing the volleyball, he's having a great time, whereas Nicholas is looking at it, he's observing it, he's observing his own relationship with people in the volleyball team, he's understanding the dynamics, he's understanding how he interacts with people and how he kind of fits in, so to speak, with the people around him. And that can be a learning thing for Nicholas as well.
It's interesting that, I mean, we've talked about themes of queerness in, I think we'll probably talk about it in all of these films, and I promise that wasn't the only reason we asked you on.
No. Yes.
But it would also be a wasted opportunity because
exactly.
You can speak on it far more eloquently than we can.
I mean, the chance to speak about this film, I'm thrilled. It's so good.
Yeah. This is one of my favourite films that I've been the one to pick on this podcast.
Mm.
What I was going to go back to was, this is the most explicitly queer film of the four because it does actually deal with themes of queerness. But it is interesting that it is much more about, not to say that it's a queer film, but you can enjoy it despite that.
Yeah.
That's not all I'm saying, but it is more about the experiences of a specifically queer character in a particular space and time in a society and an environment that is training you to be violent, racist, and hyper-masculine.
It reminded me of things like in World War One, like the Morning Hate and stuff like that, where the people, but stuff like that, like the, and I read a really interesting essay after it by Juliet Crochet about sort of brotherhood intentions, the militarized appropriation of homosocialism and homoeroticism. What Juliet's essay talks about is the sort of routine and what creates the brotherhood in these spaces is kind of around hatred and hatred of the other and hatred of being and like the masculinization of like hating the other person, and how those masculine, hyper-masculine traits can lead directly into hate. And I think it's interesting that it really leads into this queer lens, but it also links into the lens about sort of race that's in this film as well.
Because I think you see probably two black faces in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Not black face as in black face.
No, they do all wear camouflage, and the subtext of that is not lost on you.
Oh.
But there are two black characters in this film, neither of whom have any speaking lines. And it is clearly a very conscious decision about how they want to show the military during apartheid, that they are conspicuous by their absence. In a way that it does make you think of Beaucervais in a different way, because it's how this largely, well, totally white in the case of Moffi, but institutionally white in the case of Beaucervais, are interacting with, you know, these black and brown individuals. And it is, on the one hand, you have this weird post-colonial tension in Beaucervais of, yeah, but we're your friends now. And we're here for some reason, whereas it is just out and out hostility both to black South Africans and to the people of Angola, which is where the fighting ends up. The other similarity between this and Full Metal Jacket is that it is very clearly split in two halves between the training and the war. I think in Full Metal Jacket, the second half is weaker, whereas in this, everything that we have seen in the first half comes to the fore in the second half. And I don't want to spoil it, because I think it is really powerful the way this film ends, particularly the last couple of scenes, which are totally devastating, but I think it is so well set up by the first part of the film. You say you identify with Sax and you identify with Nicholas, Will. Did you identify with Stassen? Because I have some thoughts about this.
I identify with Stassen in the volleyball scene a lot. There was when he was playing the character of a woman that the person was wanting to have sex with. He was using his femininity as a way to endear himself to the bros. And I really relate to that in lots of settings. And in that environment, it's that sort of survival way of mode that you put your brain into. I think that I also relate in that if you've been through something of trauma, you pull away emotionally as well from even the people that you love, or even when you're not in quote-unquote wartime, you end up pulling away from those people. And that really hurts. And I think that because Nicholas is the sort of main vehicle for this, I see the pain through Nicholas's pain, but I can then relate to, I also know what that is for Strass.
From stories you've told me about your own life, which obviously we won't get into.
Work. I'm joking. We're going here. No.
No, no, no. That's all I'll say. When I was watching it, I did sort of feel, am I forcing Will to relive certain things through Nicholas? There's absolutely no reason to get into it, but I was thinking that, and you telling me that it was a hard watch made me feel kind of guilty.
It was book camp.
It was book camp. It was great.
I think there is a world where you join the army.
There is a world. I always said that there's a world where I either join the army or I'm the most, like, the most fun priest you'll ever meet.
But yeah, the reason why I asked about Stassen in particular is that, and I don't mean this as a criticism of that character, but just, and without spoiling it, there is this sacrificial element to him, which means that he sort of becomes more tertiary to the experiences of the other primary characters.
Mm.
And that kind of makes it harder for me to identify with him, because he feels like not an obstacle, but in some ways a plot function. And he feels like a totally realized character when he's on screen, but because so much of his contribution to the film is in how it affects others, it's kind of harder. I don't think he only exists as a sacrificial character, but there is that element to it which kind of makes it difficult for him to be a viewpoint.
Completely. And another reason that is I actually really praise about this movie is that so often when you have things like being on this podcast last time, I realised how much I love Brokeback Mountain. But there is this sort of thing when you get a queer romance, especially a queer romance in times that are trying for queer people, you meet these people that are the one. It seems like Stassen isn't the one for Nicholas. It's just the person who he's able to finally, like, bring something out of himself. And I quite like that.
But it's not in a cloying way, like some people have said, and this is your thoughts about Call Me By Your Name.
Yes, or Bohemian Rhapsody, where it's like not dirty or anything like that. It doesn't mean that it's any less romantic or any less beautiful.
But they're these are young guys who are discovering themselves.
Exactly.
In the most inappropriate setting for doing so.
And the idea that your relationship that you have at the age of 16, just because it's in difficult and trying times, is the one person you fixate on for the rest of time, is something that sat wrongly with me for so many films that I've watched. And it's so nice to have this sort of it's fleeting by the nature of the film and what happens to Stassen. But it's also nice to see that romance can occur and it doesn't need to be life or death.
And also the fact that a happy ending isn't so necessary for something to be meaningful.
Mm-hmm. I think that not to spoil anything, but the last scene of the movie was so impactful because of what it chose to do with the storyline of Nicholas. I think it's really interesting.
It showed a real discipline.
Yes, exactly.
I listened to this interview with Hermanus where he said that during the making of this film, they didn't watch many films, particularly not war films, particularly not queer films, because they didn't want to internalize tropes that would make it feel inauthentic. They wanted everything to feel, you know, realistic to these characters and true to these characters, and not just reliant on narrative conventions that were satisfactory. And I think that shows a real integrity of filmmaking, and I really, really respect that.
And I think that there are some things that, as a queer person, I can't understand, not being from South African or Afrikaans descent or descent of mixed heritage, or living at that specific time in apartheid. But because of the resonances, I really feel empathetically powerful to them. I think there's my life before and after the swimming pool scene. That is such a powerful scene in this movie, and the one take nature of it as well, and where it's placed in the narrative is kind of perfect.
I think it's the best scene in the film. In a film full of amazing scenes.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think this film is great. Oliver Hermanus also has just, you know, done huge amounts of work to contribute to South African queer cinema throughout his career, so I really want to check out more of his work.
He's recently made Living, the English language remake of Kurosawa's Ikiru, which I wasn't interested in watching at all until I found out he directed it.
That's wild. I had no idea. Bram Dutoit as the composer, take a fucking bow, because this... The music in this film is amazing. It is so powerful and fills in the gaps that otherwise would be done by dialogue, but it's so much more impactful because in those moments, when you're not necessarily hearing everything, you feel like you're there in the room. And I think the best film composition... I mean, some people have criticized it for being too over the top, but I think it fulfills such a specific function of drawing you in and allowing you to engage with these characters on an emotional level without the artifice of speech.
I think some of the most impactful things is that it creates a sense of chaos in... And it really ramps up the tension like Beau Travail did, but the chaos is loud and brash and you feel scared. I remember watching the train scene at the very beginning of this movie, and you're just almost having a small anxiety attack because you're like, oh my gosh, what are these people going to get themselves into? And that's purely a case of fantastic sound editing with lots of people's different voices, but plus this amazing score.
It ain't no Hogwarts Express.
This is,
but it is equally hostile to queer people.
Yeah, literally!
I was about to make the same joke.
Another thing to really add about this film is I love some of the visuals that are created by this film, especially stuff that's set in the sunset are really gorgeous. The silhouettes that are created in some of the sunset scenes. And I think that's another resonance to Top Gun, that the way that they create sunset vistas. It reminded me of this weird comparison to make. It reminded me of the start of Rogue One in a lot of these, Star Wars Rogue One in a lot of these films. Just,
I haven't seen Rogue One since it came out.
Okay. It reminded me a lot of Star Wars Andor. No, I'm joking.
Don't say Andor's name in vain. Andor fucks hard.
No, it's really... Some of the scenes are so beautiful, and the way that both this film and Top Gun play with the sunset in when you're looking at the cinematography is gorgeous.
Can I make an observation before we move on to availability? I don't know why the fuck I'm asking. This is my podcast.
Yeah.
I'm keeping time, though.
Yeah, no, we really are. I'm definitely going to be able to see Trainspotting. 35mm, baby.
Really?
That's...
Well, no, we're not going to make it in time anymore.
Okay. I'll explain to you why that's not a big deal. The way that we were kind of talking about this at the beginning of the section and off mic was, okay, we're going to need to prepare. This is going to be a pretty sad and dark film to talk about. But I think the way that we've communicated how we all reacted to it and how it's... At least for me, and I assume with you guys, how it sat with us. I think the word I'd use to describe it, rather than upsetting or sad, it's just a very moving film. And that sounds very basic, but in the best way. Yeah. That it is a film that fully gets you into a character's perspective and experiencing the world through another's eyes, which, you know, is why we love the movie.
But yeah. Also, there's what you're talking about, Beau Travail, about being a vibe film. This is a film that creates that mood.
100%. Okay, so you can rent this film on Amazon, Google Play, Chili, YouTube, Curzon Home Video and Apple TV, and you can buy it on all of those platforms other than Curzon, but you can also buy it on Rakuten TV.
Who are they?
They always show up.
Rakuten TV. I know.
Every movie.
I'm very glad that this film is so readily available to stream.
Yes.
Or to rent. I think more people should see it, and it's got me very interested to see Living, actually. And I did not expect to say that today. All right, shall we move on to our next film?
My name is Freeze. Plan it well. Was the chilling sound of your doom.
This is the way the world could end.
Please, show some mercy.
With ice. With a kiss.
With venom. I probably should have mentioned this. I'm poison.
Poison ivy.
And the only man who can stop them.
I freeze. I'm Batman.
Can't do it alone.
So allow me to break the ice. Here we are with Batman and Robin. It's a 1997 film directed by Joel Schumacher. Along with crime-fighting partner Robin and new recruit Batgirl, Batman battles the dual threat of frosty genius Mr. Freeze and Why did you make this so difficult?
It's not difficult if English is your first language.
Homicidal horticulturist. That's a nightmare.
Homicidal horticulturist.
Well done. Along with crime-fighting partner Batman and new recruit Batgirl, Batman battles...
Along with crime-fighting partner who?
Batman and Robin, not Robin and Batman.
Why don't you just read it slower?
Along with crime-fighting partner Robin and new recruit Batgirl, Batman battles the dual threat of frosty genius Mr. Freeze and homicidal horticulturist Poison Ivy. Freeze plans to put Gotham City on ice while Ivy tries to drive a wedge between the dynamic duo. What a film this is. Just for context,
explain why you chose this.
I firstly chose this because it is one of the first films I ever owned on VHS, so it is very dear to my heart.
Do you think it may have had an important influence on your worldview?
Undoubtedly. Look at me. No, it really is. I think what we've been talking about today in various different states is the celebration and also the toxicity of masculinity, whether that be in the sense of like a sort of a cooling of sort of the masculine tropes in Top Gun, sort of broadening out masculinity, or films like Beautiful or Moffy, where it's about toxic masculinity, etc. This takes the tropes of quite a toxic masculine character, Batman, and camps everything up to 11. And I love it for that. I love that this film is not a good film, but it's also...
A great film.
It's a film that is over the top and silly. There is an Iceman. You have all of these wonderful, wonderful characters. You've got actors turning it up to 11. And I think there's also a key... And we've been talking about masculine relationships. There's a key masculine relationship between Batman and Robin in this film and between Batman and Alfred that's all about those kind of like bro-y relationships that are quite toxic, and also with Batman and Alfred, male relationships that are quite positive, and it has a nice duality in that, as well as it having this sort of sense of like kind of mocking and not taking seriously Batman and Robin's ridiculousness around Poison Ivy.
It's insane. I mean, their whole dynamic, it's more of a thing in Batman Forever, but Robin is old. He's not the boy wonder in this film or in Batman Forever. It's more of a problem in Batman Forever because Batman seems more like an older brother than a father figure, which I think is a way to go, but George Clooney kind of is between young and middle-aged in this film. Whereas Val Kilmer in Batman Forever is more of an old young.
Yes, exactly. And I think that he's positioned in this film more like Nightwing rather than Robin, I always think.
Well, his costume deliberately evokes Nightwing.
Yes.
For those of you that don't know, Nightwing is the mantle that Dick Grayson, the first Robin, takes up when he leaves Batman's side.
Do you imagine that listeners to this podcast wouldn't know that?
I would be very disappointed. I think if my parents listened to this episode,
yes,
they
exactly.
might need to know who Nightwing is.
So does anybody who watches this film give a shit about the Bat family?
It's all about the villains.
I'm sorry. It's the Arnie and Uma show.
Okay. This brings me on to a point I wanted to make. And it's a question I wanted to ask you both. Kim Basinger in L.A. Confidential. John Cusack in In-N-Out. Minnie Driver in Good Will Hunting. Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights. And Gloria Stewart in Titanic. Which of these would you kick off of the nominations for Best Supporting Actress in order to make space for Uma Thurman in this movie?
I think all of them. And all of them should be kicked off the list. And it should just be a category of just Uma Thurman. The way that she says... She is given not much. Because I've made this note. And I didn't really think about this until episode, we watched it. So many of her scenes, she's just either talking to herself or and just doing exposition lines about like what her state of mind is in this exact bit, or to Bane, who is kind of like canvas. She has conversations with Batman and Robin, she has conversations with Mr. Freeze, which are fabulous. But like in the early parts of the film, it's just her acting on herself, and she is wringing out the rag. I mean, Toni Collette in Hereditary could not wring out the rag as much as this.
She is taking out bits of furniture from her teeth because she has chewed the scenery so well.
And it's, I was worried that I'd look at this film as a 26-year-old now, as opposed to the sort of 7 or 8-year-old, and think, oh, Uma, I love you, but like you are being too ridiculous. But no, it's perfectly placed. It's so ridiculous. And the way that she says lines in this sort of ID, it's so Eartha Kitt's Catwoman. It's brilliant.
Yes, it is. That's exactly it. Because people thought she was just going to be like a new Michelle Pfeiffer.
Mm.
But no, she's Eartha Kitt.
Yes, exactly.
Which is perfect for this style. She is so locked into the style of this film. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is kind of as well, but not on her level. She is just
amazing.
They're
having fun.
Yes.
They're having
fun. And George Clooney very much isn't.
But I kind of love that even more. I love the fact that George Clooney's Batman he's obvious that he's hating every experience that he's doing in this film.
Here's the thing, that's okay for Batman, mm-hmm. but not okay for the actor playing Batman.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unless you're Tommy Lee Jones, it is very difficult to make hating the movie you're in engaging.
Yes.
But I do love the idea of an 8-year-old Will Paxton watching this film and his parents thinking, wow, he really likes Uma Thurman. And then like a few years later going, oh, that's how he liked Uma Thurman.
I loved Uma Thurman's eyeshadow. I liked her costumes.
She changes costumes, costume and hair every scene. Every. Sometimes there's like minutes between scenes, so she's got a whole new hairdo. She's an icon. But yeah, he's a drag set. So you show up on stage, full gorilla costume, slowly take it off to reveal a Poison Ivy costume, the music, Toxic by Britney Spears.
Yes! Easy.
Done.
What would be crazy is if in the next Matt Reeves Batman film, they have a charity gala where Batman shows up as Batman.
Yep, and pulls out the credit card, which says Batman Forever on it, which is wild. I was like, this is so dumb. Joel, also every extra is gay. Every extra in this film is gay, and I love it for that.
The gang, where they go into that gang hideout, the neon guys, and they just start like snapping their fingers and going into dance poses before the fight.
But those guys are in Batman Forever, but they're more neon in this film.
Yes.
Like that is
they just turned up the neon.
That is, other than Chris O'Donnell and Michael Goff, that is the closest continuation. It's so, just this film makes no sense, and it's so much fun, especially like with the oversaturation of very similar superhero films. And look, I have a lot of fondness for the MCU. I really enjoyed Matt Reeves' Batman movie, but this film, watching it now, you can't help but be nostalgic for a time when these things could be insane.
The scene of the Mr. Freeze's like first introduction scene in the National History Museum of Gotham, that scene contains, in one scene, Mr. Freeze with a diamond and lots of ice puns, people, the goons playing ice hockey with the diamond, Robin coming in on a motorcycle that for some unknown reason makes the shape of the Robin signal as he busts through the window, a dinosaur getting exploded, they're escaping on a spaceship, then falling off a spaceship, and Mr. Freeze getting, for some reason, wings. They surf off on the doors.
Never
used it again in the whole thing. Sail off onto the ship on doors, and then Robin is completely frozen and then is put into a boiling pot of water that didn't kill him.
It's put into a tub of water that Batman slowly heats up. It doesn't boil it. It just gets it hot enough to melt ice.
I love that you're defending Joel Schumacher in this. I think
it's that scene makes sense. No, if I have one complaint about that scene is that they use so many ice puns that they run out of good ones after 10 minutes. And then ice puns are really hit and miss. One of them is literally him saying nice, with emphasis on the ice. He uses it's a cold day in hell twice. It's twice. They use all the good ones way too early.
Although this isn't an ice pun, but I love that when Batman enters, he says, "Hi, Freeze, I'm Batman."
I know.
It's like, yeah.
And then surfs down a dinosaur's tail.
Oh. in the air. I'm not quite sure how the surfing works, but it works for me.
Also, the way that the acrobatics are done in this film, talking about like masculinity as well, like it's so hyper feminine, every kick, move and punch that is thrown in this movie. And I love it. Like every time that the character is thrown, they are obviously on a wire and they're obviously being catapulted across the soundstage that they're on. It's brilliant.
On the subject of puns, something I was wondering while watching this film is, how does the quippy one-linery dialogue in this film differ from like Marvel Whedonisms, and why is it so much funnier here than it is in Marvel?
Because in this, I feel like the point is to be silly rather than to be clever.
Yeah.
Mm, yes.
And the emotion is melodramatic and ridiculous and, you know, not particularly good, let's be fair. It, like, this is a film that has a lot of flaws. Like, we're not saying it's a perfect movie. Whereas I feel like in Marvel films, and not just to rag on those films because that's kind of boring.
And it's probably been done in every other episode of this podcast.
Francesco, give it a rest. But often it's done to dilute the emotional moments.
True.
Whereas in this, like, the emotional moments are given the same level of camp as the one-liners.
Yep.
Alfred just clutching at his chest every time someone's not looking. Oh, yeah.
The Alfred stuff sucks in this film.
I know, I know.
It really does. And
I think, honestly, the Alicia Silverstone Batgirl stuff sucks as well.
This movie, I feel like it ruined her career, considering how promising
she was. Clueless.
Movie. Yes, that. But after Clueless, people like, she is going to be the next big thing. She should have gone on to like have the career that, I don't know, someone like Cameron Diaz has, or the early part of Cameron Diaz's
instead
career.
Instead, she was in Stormbreaker. Like, it's not gone well for Alicia Silverstone.
Because I was watching this with my partner, and we were wondering, why is she even in the film? Because there are so many character threads. You've got Batman and Robin, you've got Freeze, you've got Poison Ivy. And she's part of the Alfred storyline, but the reason why she joins the Bat family has got nothing to do with Alfred. And our theory is that they shoehorned her in because they needed someone for the girl audience to identify with that wasn't Poison Ivy. And it backfired because she was so boring that everyone just focused on Poison Ivy, and every girl watching that film had their gay awakening thanks to Poison Ivy.
I think
Ivy.
There are two reasons why she's in this film. One is Alicia Silverstone is really hot at this moment as the next movie star. So the, like, this makes perfect sense. It's Warner Brothers' biggest film coming out. Batman Forever, whatever you think of that film, was very successful.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, I think that they wanted to introduce a through line either for this or for future films so that Robin could have a love interest and make the idea of Robin and Batman less gay.
Yep.
No, and I'm not saying that as a bit. Yeah. Like, I think that was such an anxiety. And they worked so hard in Batman Forever to de-homoeroticize Batman and Robin. In this film, they simultaneously bring in a love interest for Robin. Batman has a girlfriend whose name I can't even remember.
It's Elle Macpherson, the model. That's what I
mean. Yeah, I know it's Elle I know it's Elle Macpherson, but she's such a nothing character.
Yeah.
Whereas bring in someone for Robin to like... There's this thing that... So Connor Goldsmith, who hosts the Cerebro X-Men podcast, which I love, made a really good point about queer-coded characters in comic books. And I think it's true of all media, but particularly superhero media. No character looks more gay than when you put them in a bad straight relationship.
Wow. That's fascinating.
And I think that's kind of the case, particularly with Bruce Wayne in this film.
Well, there is there's a scene where they're showing Barbara around the grounds. I was like, aww. It's like, it's a twink and his daddy. It was so cute. They were like Barbara's uncles, like the Uncle Clooney and Uncle Chris O'Donnell. Like, it was so cute.
Well, George Clooney in this film, Batman in this film, looks more like he's confused by the fact that he's attracted to Poison Ivy than anything else. Mm. It's the first time he's attracted to a woman and he can't wrap his head around why.
Fancying Uma Thurman is gay.
Yes. Yes. Because you're fancying a drag queen.
Yes. That's the thing.
Yes, exactly. I just have some quick, I'm just going to have some quick bizarre things that I'm just going to rattle off, like quick succession bizarre things.
Hit me with it.
The extra with an eye patch in Arkham Asylum.
The guard. I was thinking that. There is no reason for that character to have an eye patch, but just sure.
Sure, why not?
Because it's a cartoon and everyone needs to like pop in some way.
Yeah.
Mr. Freeze is simultaneously an Olympic decathlete and a Nobel Prize winner. But also, that's such a like, he's amazing at sport and he's amazing at science.
I mean, you have to justify the fact that he looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
And they recorded him falling in that ice. Can they show that video of it?
Oh, yes, they do.
When they're showing his origin. But, like, who was recording that?
I know.
Who was recording half... Sorry to cut you off. There there's a point where I think...
I know exactly what you're saying.
Is it... who is it that's watching? Oh, no, where Mr. Freeze is watching his... What's it called? Well, there's two
home
scenes.
Videos.
Okay, yeah. So there's one point where Mr. Freeze is watching his wedding video, and at one point there's a mirror shot of him putting a necklace on his wife in a point where no camera should have been there. And there's also another point where he's watching a video of Uma Thurman pulling the plug on his wife. Again, just a camera up in Uma Thurman's face. Who was taking that video?
Who was recording it? Like... Who was recording that video? I've thought that for years. I was hoping that this film would reveal it somewhere. It's like there would be like a camera.
No, because the answer is it's a clip from the film.
Yes, the answer is a clip from the film.
Like
trying to apply logic to this film feels very pointless.
Yes, such as things like the moment in the botanical gardens of Gotham when the Lion King just happens as the introduction, like the weird dancing thing for that. And then finally, I just want to talk about Oxbridge Academy based in London. That's where Batgirl went. She went to Oxbridge Academy based in London.
Is that
Oxbridge Academy?
Is that where she's wearing a schoolgirl uniform?
Yeah, she's wearing a schoolgirl.
She's still in school.
She's still in school.
Didn't change before getting on this really long flight.
Yep. 9 to 10 hour flight to Gotham.
Which is, as we know, in New Jersey.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's...
That's canon.
Is it?
Yeah. Some point in the 70s, I think, they released a map of where Gotham and Metropolis are in America. Gotham is New Jersey. Guess where Metropolis is?
It's not New York.
Nope.
Because they're not close.
Is it the other side? It's not the LA. No, it can't be.
No, it's on the East Coast.
Is it Boston?
No, it's Delaware.
It's Delaware?
Delaware.
It's like across the river from Gotham, but Gotham is technically in New Jersey and Metropolis is technically in Delaware. So the two biggest cities in America, according to DC Comics, are in New Jersey and Delaware.
Wow. Parallel world. Maybe.
But New York and LA also exist.
Oh.
So what the... I'm sorry. Comics are weird.
But yeah, Oxbridge Academy. I've just been thinking about that since the film. I've never heard that line before, but Oxbridge Academy. But then she said, oh, it's chilly up there in London.
But
and I was like, Oxbridge Academy.
But she sounds...
At least call say it's in Oxford. If it's not... Oh,
but
so
she
funny.
Sounds like Alicia Silverstone. She doesn't even sound British.
I know. And the last thing I want to say is the Turkish baths... is where Poison Ivy sets up her thing, and it made me think of, what's her name? I'm going to think of the name. Gay icon. That's helpful. There's lots of them. Who played the bathhouses?
The Emperor Nero?
Wait, this is going to be
gay icon for other reasons. Opera singer.
No, not opera singer. Bette Midler. Okay, here we go.
All right, time to start again.
So Poison Ivy's base is in the Turkish bathhouse, which is just a gay sauna. She set it up in a gay sauna with the neon people. And it also reminds me of, like, in the camp way that Uma Thurman is in this film, is that when Bette Midler played the bathhouses in the 90s. Like, that is what Poison Ivy is doing in these Turkish baths.
See, I think Poison Ivy is Madonna.
Yes, I could see that.
And not like that she's performing like Madonna, but I think she's coded at this moment in time to be the sort of gender figure that Madonna is.
Mm. As I told Lady Freeze. God, can I freeze?
She sounds like Rosalind Russell in His Girl Friday.
It's so good. Oh, and there's also, yeah, it's
Uma Thurman is so good in this film.
She's so good in this film.
So the first Batman movie, the first Burton one is Joker. Second one is Penguin and Catwoman. Batman Forever is Riddler and Two-Face. Do you think that by the time Batman and Robin comes out, they feel like they're scraping the barrel for when the villains are Mr. Freeze, Poison Ivy, and Bane, or because of the cartoon, Poison Ivy and Mr. Freeze at least were A-list characters?
Oh, that's a really interesting thing. I think Mr. Freeze has always been quite high up on the rogues gallery, specifically.
Ever since the cartoon, yeah, because the best episode is a Mr. Freeze episode.
Yes, maybe that is right. It may be more related to the cartoon.
Because
stuff.
It totally like rewrote that character. Because he was just a guy with a freeze gun in the 60s.
I wonder who else you could do. I mean, I'm trying to think of the rogues gallery in general.
Well,
I mean,
Scarecrow.
Scarecrow would be a good one. I mean, I'm surprised with how batshit crazy this film is that Man-Bat isn't in it.
Man-Bat and Scarecrow were going to be the next one if Schumacher had got to make another one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Man-Bat. Coolio is... Oh, yeah, Coolio's in this film.
Well, an idea was that he'd be Scarecrow. I think it was going to be... If it had been made, it was going to be Nicolas Cage. Which is perfect for
We've
Scarecrow.
We've been robbed.
Would have been
We've
a great
been
Scarecrow.
Fucking robbed by 1997 audiences.
I want more films like this. I think that like the Marvel like stuff on this, I just want more films that are this silly.
But even without ragging on Marvel, like we had 20 years of edgy, boring, just outright, just drab Batman movies.
20 years, really?
I mean, like, Nolan...
2005 was about
to Yeah, it's almost 10 years ago.
But I don't think those are dreary. I think that, especially the first two, they're kind of fun. You can maybe make that argument for Dark Knight Rises, even though I wouldn't. But Dark Knight Rises has Anne Hathaway being amazing.
That's true. Anne Hathaway is amazing. I think
it's really just like a five-year stretch when Zack Snyder's controlling everything DC does.
But I think that in those films, it's totally dark with moments of levity, whereas there's not the silliness of Batman. And Batman is still broody. Batman's not the funniest bit in those films.
No, but Batman hasn't been the focus of a Batman film since the 1989 Batman, by the time Batman and Robin comes out.
That's true.
It's always been about the villains ever since. Even when Jack Nicholson is your villain, Batman was the focus. Ever since then, it's been about the villains.
But yeah, no, so about Arnie, because he's top billed, but he's not top billed Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze. It's just his name. So my theory is that with a lot of the performances and a lot of the camp, it's a kid's film in a way that we're not really used, you know, superhero movies being anymore. Mm.
But it's not anymore. And now it's a gay adults film.
Yeah, no, but like, it was marketed as a kid's film. Sure. And this
I want to go shopping and buy a costumes film.
And buy toys.
Yeah, yes. And this is 90s Arnie. This is, you know...
Kindergarten Cop.
Twins. Jingle All the Way.
True Lies. When he's trying to be a comic actor.
Yeah. So the kids' audience would have recognized his name over George Clooney.
Well, George Clooney was hardly a movie star at this point. He was mainly known for TV. He'd done, like, some good performances in film, but he's not there yet. And this film doesn't launch him the way that you might expect. I mean, it would be crazy if he became a movie star off the back of this film and still became the George Clooney we know today. It's not really until, I guess, Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
Where people are like, oh my God, this is the most charming man alive. How were you such a bland Batman? Because if you literally took Danny Ocean and put him in a Batman suit, perfect, I think it would suit this film really well.
I think that...
But he's so lost in this film.
And I wonder if he would be a brilliant... Because I'm trying to think about the best Bruce Waynes we've had as opposed to the Batmans. I think that... I actually like Robert Pattinson's Bruce Wayne a lot.
Emo Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, emo's Bruce. I like that sense of
he's Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, yes. I like that sense of like he's not fully like got into the.
He's not
like,
enjoying himself yet.
No, he's not enjoying himself. He's not playing the character. He is Batman at this point. Later on, Batman then is more of a drag queen.
Grant Morrison, who a lot of people think of as quite an esoteric or countercultural comics writer, has written a lot of Batman comics, and he wrote this really famous one called Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth, where Batman is like the screwed up, crazy person that like some people think he should be in every adaptation and every comic. But he wrote in that this doesn't take place in the normal DC universe. I think that if Batman was crazy, he would be very unsuccessful. Batman only works as a character and can only actually achieve anything because he's a pretty stable person.
Mm.
And he takes a bit of fun in what he does. If he was just brooding and, you know, manic and crazy, then he doesn't survive long enough to make four films.
Yes, exactly.
So I think, like, if you have a Batman that is, you know, not bland in the way that Clooney is, but is able to engage with the world, we're so obsessed with damaged heroes that we start to glamorize the damage rather than the damage being overcome.
It's why Kevin Conroy is still, in my opinion, the best Batman, because there is a sense of playfulness both in his Batman and his Bruce Wayne, even though you can sell the damage is there. It's the damage doesn't override the person.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, can we just talk quickly about Bane?
Oh, yeah, we haven't talked about Bane.
Bane is... I like Bane. A lot of people are very annoyed because they made Bane stupid in this film. And I get it, because it's basically a totally different character. He's just a dumb muscle. But it's funny.
It is funny.
And, like, when he's wearing his little chauffeur's outfit, but with the mask.
I think my favourite thing about Bane in this film is that there's the scene where Pamela becomes Poison Ivy, and Ivy first when she's getting pushed, and they have the shot of, like, Bane being created, flashing the muscles. Then, three scenes later, when we see Poison Ivy the first time, she says, "Come on, Bane," and he's still in that muscle pose. And my headcanon is that for the 3 days between those two scenes, Bane has just been flexing his pecs the entire time, and his biceps the entire time.
My favourite moment is that rather than like saying we're leaving, Poison Ivy at one point says to Bane, "Exit," and he just goes, "Exit."
I know, he's kind of funny. It's also interesting that, like, I'm a bit concerned about the idea that once you've taken the venom out of Bane, he's useless. Because that man is a mass murderer by the descriptions of him that they were given. And he just left there. He's like, now he's not big, he won't do anything. It's like, he's a mass murderer. Like, maybe, like, lock him up?
Well, yeah, like, in the comics, he's a big guy that gets bigger when you give him that steroid. Whereas in this, like, he's a pretty skinny guy.
He's a very skinny guy.
Like, maybe... you'd get better results if you start with a big guy and then make him bigger.
Yes.
But it's not as showy.
But he's not very tall. Like, he's tallish, but like he's not like a giant. He's just, like, very muscly.
There's also that scene where he's pushing the cart, the Arkham Asylum branded cart.
Oh, my God.
And then policemen are just throwing themselves at him and bouncing off of it.
Bane, my hero.
I know. Have you seen the Harley Quinn cartoon version of Bane? Because that's now my favourite version of Bane.
It kind of reminded me of Harley Quinn version of Bane. Even though that version of Bane isn't, like, just dumb muscle. But
no.
The sort of frustration of being treated like a second-tier villain.
Yes.
I'm like, does the Bane in Harley Quinn resent the way he was portrayed in Batman and Robin by Joel Schumacher?
I think he resents how he was portrayed as Dark Knight Rises and Batman and Robin.
But he sounds like Tom Hardy.
Yeah, it's really a parody of Tom Hardy.
I think it's a parody of both. But it's really funny because obviously he's got the Tom Hardy voice.
Just to end this, just to wrap this up and just to give praise to Joel Schumacher, because he gets shat on a lot for this film and he's apologised for this film, etc. But I have a lovely time every time I watch it, and it's a really good feel good film. George Clooney tells a story on Graham Norton about Joel Schumacher's directing style, in that he has a megaphone and that he says, like, before the take, right, George, like, your parents are dead, everything doesn't matter anymore, and action. And to me, that is this film in a nutshell, is it's like, it's the celebration of, like, high drama camp.
People love working with Joel Schumacher. Like, everyone except Val Kilmer just really likes him, even when they're not proud of the films they made. The last thing I kind of wanted to say, actually, was I was thinking about this film fairly recently, because during a sort of a down mental health period, which has passed now, I was comfort watching The Big Bang Theory because I'd never properly seen it. And I was like, I'm kind of interested because this went on for like 11, 12 seasons. There's got to be something. So
and as a subject matter, like even if you don't find it funny, it's like
it's interesting. I started watching, like, from when Melissa Rauch and Mayim Bialik were introduced, because then it becomes less about these nerds who can't get girls and also becomes about nerds interacting with having girlfriends. I also just think those two actors are great and make the whole show a lot more enjoyable.
Agreed.
But there is a line where Jim Parsons is talking about his enemies list, and he said, oh, and high up on the list is Joel Schumacher for directing Batman and Robin, which destroyed the Batman franchise. I'm like, that is such a dumb, basic take to be said in the 2010s. Like, what? It's just so reductive and boring. And yet, this did cause Batman films to languish for a few years. But firstly, who cares? Second of all, like, there is so much to love in this film.
Yes. And 8 years was the difference of time. It's not like Doctor Who that was taken off the air for 20 years.
Yeah.
Because of bad decisions. It was 8 years. And in that time, we had Spider-Man and X-Men. And it was fine.
And we got Batman Begins out of it.
Exactly.
Which is a good film.
Yeah. Like, it's just different tonal things. And I think that...
But the basicness of that take and the sort of universally accepted version of events regarding this film is so frustrating. And I do think that it's had a real renaissance in terms of public opinion in the last few years. There's a great Patrick Willems video where he talks about, no, this is actually, it's not like a perfect film, but it shouldn't be hated.
No.
It should be at worst a curiosity.
Yeah.
And at best a good time.
It's a good time. And I think that, like, I don't understand that, because I think that having rewatched Batman Forever quite recently, actually, it's the kind of the same film. It follows exactly the same plot beats.
But these people also don't like Batman Forever.
I'm sure they don't, but Batman Forever was a success that led to this film. So why was this the film that was incredibly panned? I don't know what it is.
Because people saw Batman Forever, didn't like it, and then didn't see Batman and Robin in the same numbers.
Yeah.
So you can fool people once. That's the thing.
Yes.
If it's something they don't like. But anyway, we're not going to talk about the bat nipples because, frankly, everyone has.
Yes,
the bat ass.
Oh, the bat ass.
Oh, the bat ass we can talk about.
Sure. What do you want to say about the bat ass that hasn't been said?
There's two of them.
There are two bat
asses. No, there are three.
There's also bat girl ass.
Bat girl ass.
I think it's more interesting is the high heel shot of Batgirl is more interesting, where she stomps her feet. She goes bam, bam as the heels go down. So, again, camp. And I will be wearing... This will be my Halloween costume this year.
Batgirl?
No, Poison Ivy. Yeah.
I think everyone's.
As you said, the gorilla costume into Poison Ivy.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
You will overheat and die. All right, so availability. You can stream this on Sky and Now Cinema. You can rent it on Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Sky Store, Chili, Microsoft, YouTube, and guess what? Rakuten TV. And I believe you can buy it on all those platforms as well. So, just to finish up, why don't you ask the double bill question?
So, Will, if Top Gun is the main course in a wonderful meal you're having, which of the three alternates is dessert?
This is an easy one.
Batman and Robin.
It's Batman and Robin. It's got to be Batman and
it's
Robin.
It's an icy dessert.
It's a jelly.
It's a jelly?
It's a well-sculpted jelly.
Oh, no, I see. I think it's
a... It's wobbly.
It's gelato. It's a frozen dessert. It's the icing on the cake.
I think it's a messy trifle. That's what I think it is. A trifle that's been homemade and got lots of sprinkles on the top that shouldn't go on the trifle.
In your opinion, what's the gayest dessert? Because I don't think it is trifle.
Tiramisu.
Tiramisu is very gay.
Yeah, or a Viennetta. It's aesthetically pleasing whilst kind of camp and ridiculous. Can't even just describe a Viennetta as camp and ridiculous.
No, but...
I see.
I mean, queer men, spotted dick.
Well, that's unfortunate. I think a certain sort of queer man.
Was it? No, but like, as an actual answer, Batman and...
As an actual answer,
Batman and Robin, because...
Pretty unanimously.
No, because, like, you know, even, like, Top Gun is a fun movie. It's a bit... It's fun and it's camp and...
It's not crazy.
Yeah, and the films that Charlie and I picked... are very resonant in terms of themes around the military and masculinity, and take a lot of those themes way more seriously, way more deeply than maybe something like Top Gun does on the surface. But at its core level, Top Gun is meant to be a fun escapist bro movie, and whilst I wouldn't say that Batman and Robin is a bro film in that sense, it's a bit of fun. Yeah. It's guys in costumes.
And it takes a lot of the same elements and just amps and then dials down the stuff that I don't like about Top Gun, which is the more bro-y elements, and dials up the more ridiculous stuff about Top Gun that I fucking love.
I think Moffy is a hearty broth.
A hearty broth. Yeah, I can do that.
Anyway, I don't even want to think about what Beau Travail is.
It's one of those desserts that, like, is like you get it and then it's like really beautifully crafted, but it's very delicate and etc. And you're like, I would.
It's
get
a creme brulee.
It's a creme brulee. It's a creme brulee. That's it.
That starts off on fire.
Yeah.
On that note,
Batman and Robin is an eaten mess.
But like, really,
it's an Oxbridge Academy mess.
It's an eaten mess, but with like really unorganic strawberries.
Yes, exactly.
It was like bright pink. Thank you as always to our esteemed producer, Jade Corbett. Thank you, Molecule, for our artwork. You can follow us on @BCUWatchPod on Twitter and @BCUWatchPodcast on Instagram. Thank you, Will, my darling, for coming.
I have had such a lovely time being here. Thank you so much. And thank you for introducing me to Moffy. Like, I'm really... it's such a beautiful film, and so is Beau Travail. But Moffy is something that
People already knew Beau Travail was great.
Moffy is a discovery that I think I will take with me for a long time.
Could you see yourself recommending it to other people?
Oh, yeah.
Then I've done my job.
Exactly. Because you watch.
And obviously, thank you, Francesco.
Well, thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening. Dun 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 dun